It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
It's time for episode 136 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This week I've got a great interview with Ted Nafee, the creator of the Courtney Crumrin series, and now has a new ongoing book coming out from Oni Press called Princess Ugg. It's a great fun title that I've enjoyed reading, and the second issue of it comes out this Wednesday, so you're going to want to be sure to pick it up. We talk about how the book came to be and all kinds of things about the characters and how this book relates to real life. There's a lot to get to, so let's get to it. I want to welcome to the podcast Ted Nafee, creator of Princess Ugg, among other great things out there from Oni Press. It's a book that I've really been enjoying. How are you doing today, Ted?
Fantastic. How are you doing?
Good, good. Why don't we get right into Princess Ugg, because I'm really enjoying it. And I'll talk with you a little bit about why I think it's such a great book. And honestly, a lot of your books have this to do. I am always so frustrated by female characters in comics. Because female characters tend to be, you know, they either have to be very maternal, or they have to be, you know, completely the other direction. And one of the things I love about Princess Ugg is that the lead character is not in any way at this point maternal.
No.
And the story, maybe why don't you go ahead and explain to folks what the basic storyline is for Princess Ugg?
It's basically the premise was a barbarian princess ends up in princess finishing school. So it's like King Conan's daughter goes to Disney princess finishing school and starts interacting with the kind of classical princess tropes established by our modern kind of the modern sort of Disney take of what a perfect young lady is. And I had a lot of fun kind of clashing those two genres together. I really like the idea of what I think of as, barbarian fantasy as established by Robert E. Howard and a number of other artists in that genre. And continued on by, you know, the Game of Thrones books and that kind of thing. I like clashing that with the more pretty, sort of like latter-day Lord of the Rings soft fantasy that's also been perpetuated by Disney.
Mm-hmm. Well, not to get Disney mad or anything, but some of the ladies in there kind of remind me of a couple of Disney characters. I can't imagine where I got that notion from. But it's so much fun because she is nothing like Disney would ever put out.
Uh-huh. Princess,
now, her real name is – how do you pronounce that?
Uga.
So that's her real name.
Yeah.
And why don't you? The question I think that people are probably going to want to know is how in the world does she end up in this place?
You got to wait till issue 3. You get a full explanation with a lovely in a lovely watercolored sequence.
Okay.
I really wanted to watercolor the whole book, but I just I did the very first page of the book, and coloring it took. A good chunk of the day, like several hours, because I really had to be careful. Now, of course, in Europe, there's watercolor books where all the book is like line art with beautifully meticulous watercolor, but they get to spend a week per page, and I don't have that kind of time. So I opted to color, just a couple of pages, just a couple of sample pages, and just a few select. Elements of it, all the flashbacks is what I wanted to color to suggest that this is out of the present time. Then I asked my colorist on Courtney Crumrin, Warren Wasinich, to color the rest. He kind of knocked it out of the park. He kind of crushed it. I feel very good about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, the art is very strong on this, you know, and of course your script is good too, because I enjoyed the characters, and the fact that you understood the characters and made them, as you know, that they breathe and they're real characters, is great, and I think that the art really works with that too. Do you want to talk a little, well, of course you do both the story and the art, so how great can that be? You know, you understand what's going on with these things, and you get to, are all these things, I mean, is this pretty much how you see things in your head before you put it on the page?
You know, oftentimes, you know, I have like bits and pieces, like I'll have a scene, and that scene kind of like, or a moment or a piece of dialogue, and that piece of dialogue feels right for a character. And then I realize as I start to script it out and draw it, I realize, oh, I have no idea what this character really is going to look like. Like the, you know, the other princesses, I kind of knew what Princess Julifer would look like. But when I sat down to draw her, I realized, well, you know, actually I don't. I mean, I have cliches in my head, and now I just have to really sit down and kind of go, okay, well, what specifically would this character look like? What would her gown look like? What colors would she choose? Like, I kind of wanted her to be red and yellow, you know, like kind of fiery, but canary, you know? But then I thought, well, I wanted to like suggest that there's a history and there's a, and there's a culture around this outfit. And then I realized that the other princesses kind of had that too. My only real, I feel like, where it sort of fails is I want to work a little harder on the Gothic princess's outfit. And like, cause I feel like, you know, there's a lot of potential there, but, you know, because she was Gothic and, like, that's a bunch of stuff that I just kind of, I do without really thinking. I just knock it out without thinking. I didn't really put the time and thought into what would, like, medieval Gothic princessliness look like. I just kind of threw her into a tattered dress and just didn't think much more about it. But regardless, yeah, I really wanted to build, like, a life and a suggestion of history into all the characters' costumes.
Well, you did a pretty good job with that, because you get a sense of who these people are by their appearance, you know, and how they act.
Yeah.
And that's a good thing, because, you know, you don't have a lot of time to establish these the secondary characters. No, you've got Ugg pretty well established, and her opposite number, shall we say.
Princess Julifer.
Yes. Now, I have to say that in the very first book, the way that they meet had me laughing right out loud.
Oh, great. Yes. That would be funny. Sweet.
You know, I have to say that I don't know how much you want. I don't want to spoil things that shouldn't be told, because the second book hasn't come out yet, and I've had a chance to read that, too.
Oh, great. Yeah. Go ahead and spoil it. I mean, I think by the time this podcast comes out, the book will be newish, and you know, I find that spoilers kind of whet the appetite.
Okay. Well, I like teasers. I don't necessarily like spoilers.
Teasers,
So I like to be teased, but and the what happens is when Princess gets into the city where she's supposed to be, the first basic person she runs into is the other princess who's being very carefully chauffeured through the city.
Yes.
And let's just say that she ends up in something a little reminiscent of Back to the Future.
Yes. Yes.
And I just busted out laughing, because, you know, there's nothing more funny, it seems like, than when somebody of a high station in life doesn't get to live up to that high station in life.
Yeah, for sure.
All the time. And so the two, and then the interesting thing is the two of them go on, let's say, when they get to the school, they have a more interactive relationship than they thought they were going to have. And the two of them together are total opposites. And I think that's one of the things that makes this book so much fun to read. Is that, you know, by the end of this, that Princess Ugg's going to learn a lot from her, but she's also going to pick up a couple of things from Princess Ugg.
Yeah.
Which I hope. So, you know, as far as the characters go, you know, they're very strongly established. We understand why they don't like each other right from the start.
Well,
and
I mean,
this great stuff.
The other thing, of course, is that, you know, Olga, of course, is a barbarian. Or from a, you know, much more primitive culture that, like, doesn't value the sort of pomp and circumstance and the things like luxury, as it is carefully explained in the first issue. But there's a form of barbarism that the sort of, that, you know, decadent advanced, if you know, for lack of a better word, advanced societies kind of indulge in, which is that, you know, the people at the top basically get their own way. I mean, at the end of the day, it's kind of hard to escape the might makes right mentality. And at the, you know, and so what ended up happening was you have this clash of two different kinds of barbarism, where it was just assumed that it was completely okay to whip this, you know, peasant girl out of the way when, but it turns out that Olga is anything but a peasant girl and she has strength of her own. And I thought that that was a fun kind of clash of these two like different forms of barbarism.
See, that to me is it explains a lot of what's going on in the first book and also in the second, because I have to say in the second book, as much as I liked Princess Saga in the second, I feel so sorry for her in the second book.
Yeah.
You took, you know, what was a real interesting character, and we get to see her. Let's just say that she's not able, that she's in a situation that she doesn't know how to handle, and she doesn't take it necessarily well.
She's not in her place of strength, you know, and she's very used to being in her place, in a place of strength, you know, which of course is one of the things that really destabilizes you in an adventure is when you're in your comfort zone where you're very good at everything and then you're suddenly thrust out of it. And, you know, and that's where it really, like, it's revealed what kind of character you have. How do you handle it? And I thought that was a fun, kind of exciting concept.
See, this to me is what I've been longing for, to have a female character who was actually, you know, a fleshed out character who was real, who was human. You know, it's, you know, Storm just throws storms around and other people just do, you know, and nothing against those other characters. But it's just that women just don't seem to be as developed, and not necessarily in a physical way, but in an emotional, mental way, like the men are. Men can be scoundrels, men can be villains, men can be Lex Luthor, who is Shades of Grey, but the women are all very much black or white and they're so dull to read. And you know, honestly, you know, I think very much that there's a huge female audience for comics, and they're starting to get into this kind of stuff.
Absolutely.
And I think this is the kind of book that I hope that stores will take to female customers and say, did you read this yet? Read this.
Yeah.
You know, and well, you know, you did Courtney Crumrin before, which was another strong female character. And so I just hope that this kind of catches on and that this is actually something, the beginning of new, stronger female characters in comics.
Well, when I sat down to do Courtney Crumrin, I had realized at that point that because of the books that I had started to see popping up in my early 20s, you know, The Sandman and the, you know, books like that, I started to see this larger and larger growing population of women readers that were picking up these books, and they wanted more comics. They loved the medium. They loved they loved the Sandman world, but they loved the medium because it has this opportunity to create such lushness and beauty. And so they go and look around. So what else is there? And there's just nothing. You know, there wasn't much at the time. And I kind of, so for me, Courtney Crumrin was like an answer to that to some degree, you know, like, let me put out something that, you know, those readers will immediately snap up. And I thought, of course, well, it'll of course blow doors, you know, it'll like everybody will jump up on it. But I mean, Courtney Crumrin, of course, being a children's book wasn't quite the same thing as Sandman. And I think that a lot of the teenagers and young adults that were looking for something like Sandman weren't looking for children's material. It might have been a little esoteric, but that being said, it did do very well you know, for a children's comic. It turns out that children's comics aren't that popular anymore, but it did do very well, and it continues to do well. Here it is, like 12 years later, the first volume still sells consistently, and it's still in print, and that's to me, I assume that that's a good thing, that like a book that I published 12 years ago is still consistently, you know, at low levels in print. So, but I wanted to, I wanted to do something a little more adult, and a little more, also something that no male reader would look at the cover of Princess Ugg and go, oh, that's for girls. That's not for me. which I feel good about. I feel like it is clearly a book about a female character, and there's nothing about her that says this is a male empowerment fantasy. it is a book that's clearly a women's empowerment fantasy, but no boy would look at it and go, oh, that's just for girls. Mm-hmm. And I feel really good that was something that I feel like I've managed to achieve that. That was definitely mm-hmm. a goal.
Well, I think you have, because it entranced me when I started to read it. When you look at her on the cover, she is clearly a barbarian princess.
Yeah.
And you know, I don't think that guys necessarily don't want to read female characters that are interesting. Yeah. I think this is a big mistake that the comics industry makes.
Yeah.
And I think my hope, and if your other materials are still selling years later, mm-hmm. that's a sign that there's something that's not being filled.
Yeah.
In the comics industry. And to me, I just, you know, the books like Princess Saga are what we need more of.
Yeah.
It feels like to me. Because, you know, the comics industry right now is struggling. You know, we need to have, we can't only have male readers. We need to attract as many people as possible.
Yeah.
And so I think you're on the right road.
I hope so. I mean, I'm doing my best. And mm-hmm. it feels like the book is starting to blow up, which is nice. Mm-hmm. You know, it feels like I got a lot of reviews of the first volume and the first issue, and a lot of discussion about it. There's a lot of excitement and anticipation about it. And you know, we'll see where it goes, but I feel like it was a more immediate reaction, positive reaction right out of the starting gate than anything else I've done so far. Mm-hmm. That was my own kind of, you know, writer artist creation. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking forward to see what happens with it. It was just for me a natural evolution from doing Courtney Crumrin to doing Polly and the Pirates, which was a little more teenage, but still very sweet, very soft. I think of it as like, you know, regardless of the fact that Polly is all, you know, bright blue and, you know, like pirate colors and like, you know, sun drenched, crimsons and whites and whatnot, but I think of it as like there's a little bit of pink on that book, and there's a little bit of pink on Courtney Crumrin, which mm-hmm. is to say, boys look at it and go, "Oh, that's for girls." Mm-hmm. And so, but you look at the cover of Princess Ugg, and you pick it up and you read through it, and there's not a lot of pink on it. It's not. It doesn't have a code about it that says this is just for girls, not for boys. And I'm hoping that changes. That gets boy readers looking at it too. But, you know, my main goal, obviously, from the start is to do books that the growing number of female readers are going to want to pick up.
Mm-hmm. And I applaud that. Yay. I really do. I really think that's something. Now, one of the things I also enjoyed about it was some of the names that you chose for things, like where Princess Olga comes from is Grimeria.
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 Like, you've heard of Conan, of course. Mm-hmm. Well, Conan mm-hmm. comes from Cimmeria. But I thought, well, what if it was even grimmer? Because Cimmeria never really kind of tripped off the tongue, but Grimmeria feels more like that's a place that a barbarian, you know, an ancient barbarian kingdom, that's a good name for that. So Grimmeria.
I like that, because that's the grim part is something great, because when she comes, she is very grim as she comes in. You know, she reflects where she comes from. Just the namings of things are kind of fun. And, of course, the Princess Academy is a great name for it. How do you pronounce the kingdom where the academy is located?
Etrusca,
okay, because there's an A-E in there, and that makes me always think it could be the A or it could be the E.
Yeah, well, so it could be Etrusca, but I just say Etrusca because it's, you know, it's faster. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I just looked, a lot of this was like Olga, you know, I came up with the name Olga, and because I wanted her to have a name that sounded like Ugg, so that, you know, as you saw in the second issue, mm-hmm. The name Princess Ugg was the name that the other princesses gave her because they think she's a cave woman.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to come up with a name that sounds like Ugg, but was mm-hmm. actually a, you know, a nice name. And so mm-hmm. I came up with Olga, and it was at first it was just Olga with an O, and then I thought, no, it should have a U, so it looks like Ugg. Mm-hmm. So I put Olga with a U, and then I thought, mm-hmm. you know what? To make this extra heavy metal, let's add a little umlaut over it.
Yeah, and the double dots. Yeah, because that's kind of fun. See, a lot of the creativity that goes into this book is something that I think is going to appeal to everybody that picks it up.
Well, I hope so.
Because what you're doing is you're telling a story, and it's a good story that people really need to read. Because comics is literally about you know, understanding stories and getting told stories.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you take it and plop it in the bag and board it and seal it up and never open it, what good is it?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, see, I couldn't agree more.
See, and the story that you're telling, I kind of have some ideas where I think it's going to go, but I would never tell them because I don't want people to think that, because I'd rather the people buy the book and enjoy it as it is. And, you know, I don't want to spoil the second book, but all I can think of, there's so many things that happen in the second book that are things I really want people to be able to read and enjoy.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate that.
Because, you know, you've got – there are things that happen to her that I – and also to the people around her. It's not just her. Other characters are going. We meet the lady that's in charge of the academy.
We meet
other people. And sad to say that a lot of what happens to Princess Ugg is something that even I as a guy can relate to when I went through high school.
Oh, yeah.
You know, if you're not in the popular group, you are considered an outcast and you are treated as such.
Mm-hmm.
And so what she's going through actually has a lot to say, I think, not only to adults, but probably like teenagers and things like that as they're going through their schooling experience.
Well, I mean, largely, you know, of course, it's based on my experiences. And, you know, I was not a girl in high school. I was a boy. I just based it on like a lot of my experiences of, you know, feeling, not necessarily just in high school, but like, you know, going into a new workplace and feeling it doesn't end in high school, that stuff. That stuff is kind of universal. It feels like it ends in high school because you learn how to deal with it. You learn how to contend with those feelings and how to, like, you learn how to make friends and, you know, get out of that feeling of feeling like an outcast. And, like, the other thing I wanted to, you know, do in the story is to kind of indicate that, like, all the girls, to some extent, feel like outcasts or have felt like outcasts. You know, the gothic princess gets made fun of because poofy sleeves are so last century, and she's still got the poofy sleeves, and she doesn't really have a pointy hat, and it wouldn't go with her hair. You know, and the pointy hat is like, that's what's now, that's what's new, right? And so I thought that was funny, but like, she's definitely, like, struggling to feel like she fits in. And the one girl who it's kind of generic, but I think of her as an Asian princess. I haven't actually named her land yet, or any of the other girls' lands, you know. She's the Asian princess, and when she first showed up, she could only use chopsticks, didn't know what they do with a fork. She's like, what am I bailing tiny pieces, piles of hay, you know? And so they're all kind of struggling to be normal and fit in, but they're just better at it than, you know, than Ulga does, because they do better than Ulga does because their civilizations are a lot closer to standard than hers was. And so that was kind of fun to play around with, to kind of indicate, well, they're all struggling with it. It's just that what happens when you have an extra outside-y person is that everybody gangs up, you know, and they feel like they belong more by making sure that she feels like she belongs less.
Okay. All right. One of the things that I also enjoyed was the fact of how you did her dialogue, Olga's dialogue, because she almost has a little bit of British sound to her. She uses the word bugger, which, of course, is
a British term. Yeah.
Yeah, British term. And the way that she pronounces things, she doesn't say mother, she says mither.
Mither,
and
yeah.
Other pronounces and things like that. Of course, that even makes her even more alien from the other folks.
Exactly.
Her English, the way that she speaks is close enough we know what she's trying to say, but it's far enough away that people can make fun of it.
Yes. And it makes her feel more primitive because she has very traditional kind of folksy, like Irish-influenced dialogue. Like, it turns out, like, a lot of that was Irish. The bugger thing, I like the word bugger because in the UK, this is a very dirty word indeed, but like nobody in America really knows what it means. And of course, in the UK, nobody really cares if you put it in a children's book. So it's a very handy word. I used it a lot in Courtney Cremorne as well, just because, you know, it's a funny sounding word that little kids would love. And I, you know, of course, I take a perverse delight in getting little kids to say dirty words, you know. I am not setting out to be a good influence on children. That is not my goal as a comic book creator.
But your job is to tell stories.
My job is to tell stories and create worlds and make people see and help people to, like, give people stories where they see themselves and they go, yes, that feels right. This is what life is like for me. in ways that like movies often don't. And that's one of the things I feel is really valuable about comics is that you don't have to rush a movie by a committee. You don't have to, or you don't have to rush a comic book by a committee. You don't have to take a bunch of meetings and convince money people that this is a good idea, that this will make money, that this will play in Peoria. And that, and you know, you don't have to deal with people with zero imagination telling you that, oh no, boys don't want, this won't work. We can't sell this because boys don't like it. You know, you don't have to deal with those people. I mean, like, believe me, my publishers, they try to do that. And I'm like, well, you know, do you want my book or not? And they're like, no, yeah, we want your book. And so I get to do what I want without, I can just think up an idea and do it. And that is so valuable to me. And if you're going to, if you have this opportunity to do that, and how, think about how few, I mean, even Harry Potter was, you can kind of tell that it was going to be Harriet Potter. And then something happened along the way that, you know, Harriet's don't sell as well as Harry's, you know. But, you know, somewhere in there, like Harry Potter doesn't sound like a name of a great adventure story, but Harriet Potter does. So you kind of wonder how it became Harry Potter of all names. And it sounds like a last minute change to me. And so I kind of have my suspicions about Harry Potter. But with comic books, I can just say, you know what? It's, you know, it's going to be Harriet Potter and that's that, you know, it's going to be, it's not going to be, you know, Carl Crumrin. It's going to be, you know, it's going to be this little girl and it's going to be the story about this young girl. And I get to do that. And I, you know, because nobody expects it to make money anyway. And nobody is, nobody is writing tens of millions of dollars on it. And that's such a freeing thing that I think that comic books, that that's our job as comic book creators to do that, to go out and experiment.
Well, one of the things that, that makes that possible, I think, is the fact that this is being published by Oni Press.
Yeah.
You know, you were saying a little bit before we started to record about the fact that they take chances.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and that's one of the things about Oni Press that I enjoy. I got to interview Paul Tobin about I Was the Cat.
Oh, yeah,
A couple of weeks ago, which is a great book, you know, and love to be able to talk about that. And I often think that Oni Press is the place to go to if you have stories that need to be told that might not fit into, shall we say, the big two and get into that. And but they're still good stories. You know, it's not just because certain folks won't publish it doesn't mean that it's not a good story.
Yeah.
And so for Oni Press, I'm a huge fan of theirs. I would 10 times, if I have to experiment on a book, if I have a little extra money and want to be able to buy a book, I would 10 times rather buy an Oni Press book than something else because I know that they have at least put the effort into it to make this a good story.
Exactly. They really do. They really, I mean, they make it their business to try to make their imprint as different and unique as any other, from any other comic book as possible. Their comic books do not look like even Image books, you know, like their lineup doesn't look like the Image lineup. Their lineup is much more broad and, you know, they take risks on things in much more daring ways than even Image does. And, you know, like nothing wrong with Image. Image is doing a great job of what they're doing. But I really am always impressed with Oni's willingness to just say, you know what, we're doing this, you know, and if people don't like it, too bad. It's, you know, we're doing, you know, they're really aggressively trying to do books for kids, books for younger readers. You know, that is a market that is waiting to blow up. And I really feel like they're the forefront of trying those books out. They're trying to do kind of find that perfect balance between alternative books and indie books, which is to say, you know, indie books are just books that aren't the big two, and alternative books are, you know, like tend to be much more artsy and, you know, often autobiographical. You know, like I think of the alt book as the like Top Shelf, like James Kaczulka and then you know Dan Klaus and those guys. And then indie books are like Pink, like Saga and Image. And like, and I feel like, Oni finds this perfect. And like, that's the kind of work I love to do the most is like very personal, really kind of weird, unusual art kind of stuff that also happens to be mainstream enough that anybody can pick it up and go, oh, okay, this isn't a comic about comics. This is a comic book just about, you know, a girl in a fuzzy helmet.
Mm-hmm. Well, they also do like The Bunker, which I enjoy. I think
A
great book. And Letter 44, which I think is a great book. So, you know, your books are coming out in great company, in my opinion. I think there couldn't be a better place to be than to be at Oni at this point for the stuff that you're producing. So I think it's wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like Oni is really, I mean, what with Joshua doing his work and all those guys, I feel like this might be Oni's time to really become a major, like an actual major player. I mean, they've always been this great little company, but I'm hoping that, you know, the industry and the audience are catching up with, oh, these guys are doing this. This is the stuff that we should be looking at. This is like, these are guys are doing amazing stuff.
Mm-hmm. Now, the second issue is coming out on the 16th of July.
That's, I believe that is right.
Okay. So that'll be a good one. And as I said, I've had a chance to read it and I truly enjoyed it, just like I did the first one. And this is 5-issue miniseries. Is that what it is?
It is going to be 8. It is ostensibly a miniseries, but it actually it could be a miniseries or it could. But I will probably, when I start the next one, it'll probably start with number 9.
Oh really?
Yeah, because I don't know if it's going to be immediately after I do 1 through 8 or a year later, but it will most likely start with number 9. Not definitely, but you know, I haven't had the final conversation with James Lucas Jones about this, but you know, I want it to feel like an ongoing series. Like this is the adventures of Princess Olga in like the first one will be in Etresca and the second one will probably be in the Gothic princess's land and the third one will be in the African princess's land, you know, although it'll probably be more like Morocco, and then on and on. And I'll do 4 like 8-issue story arcs for the series ultimately, you know, depending on how popular the first one is. I mean, if by the time I get to issue 8, the series is selling like, you know, 30,000 copies an issue, and then like I'm just doing this, I'm doing number 9, you know, that's it. You know, but if it's, you know, if it goes down below 5,000 and like stays there, then like I don't know, number 9 may take another year. It really depends on where, how successful it is, and you know, where, like what Oni wants to do with it, and blah blah blah.
Well, that's why it's called show business.
Yeah.
It's a business. If we could just produce these things and hand them out and just say to people, read this, and they could enjoy it without having money involved, that would be a whole other ballgame.
It would be nice, but then without the money, I wouldn't. Mm. If I wasn't hungry, I probably wouldn't be a lot more lucky about getting stuff done.
See, that's the trick. It's the eating actually helps you create the books, and so we have to.
Committing to the income that you've become accustomed to, or you know, or just needing to pay the damn rent, you know. I mean, right now I'm still there. I need to get a you know, like X amount of money in for every month just to feed my burn rate.
Well, see, what encourages me is that you have all these other stories in mind. You can tell when you read a book sometimes that there is more to the story than what's on the page. And I got that sense when I was reading Princess Ugg that there are other tales to be told.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and I didn't realize that those other characters might be part of that.
Yeah.
So, but I got the sense that there's a depth to the story of Princess Ugg that I like to explore. When I can tell that a writer and an artist knows where they're going, that's much more fun to go along for the ride.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because just like with what you're doing, I think that there's a tremendous amount of stuff that can be done, and clearly you're aware of that, and it would be great fun to go along for the ride and be able to follow Princess Ugg as she goes along and goes through these different adventures.
Well, I mean, one of the things that for me about like when you're doing fantasy or sci-fi or any kind of genre work is, you know, one of the pitfalls of genre in movies is that the genre is no thicker than the words on the page. There's nothing beneath them. I, you know, as much as everybody seems to love Frozen, I looked at it and I thought, well, why does she have these magical snow powers, you know, and who are these stone, like little stone dwarves, and why do they exist, and what's their story, and what is the connection between them and the, and there are no answers to that, and nobody's interested in building out that world, and it's nakedly obvious upon, like, for me, even one viewing, because I'm a fantasy fan, that there's no there's no nothing beyond that one story. There's no depth in that world. It's no thicker than the words themselves. And to me, like, when I say it's Princess Olga of Grimeria, and her father is Thorgrim, and his mother and her mother is Fredrika, and, you know, here's this tradition of women going to war with the men that was started 1,000 years ago by Queen Idas, blah, 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 which you will find out more about in the next book. I really want that world to kind of come alive, to feel, to breathe, to feel like beneath the words on the page, there's this tremendous sense that of history and depth and world building.
And that's what we need more of in comics, to be honest with you. You know, you brought to mind something that I not to rag on Disney as we.
I mean, Disney, like, I really liked Mulan quite a bit because it did feel like there was more to that world than just, you know, the things that were actually happening in the story.
My favorite Disney movie, animated movie, was The Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Oh, really? Okay.
Because it was the most adult of the whole thing.
Uh-huh.
And then they get to they decide it's time to put out a sequel to it.
Uh-huh.
And they put out everything in that sequel that I was terrified they would do in the first one.
Oh, yeah.
It was just horrible.
Single terrible decision. But that's why they're straight to their direct-to-video sequels. And that's why they are direct-to-videos, because they want to do them and they want to make their money, but they don't want to be known as the purveyor of crap that they actually often are. I mean, there's definitely the two tiers. There's the upper tier and then the lower tier of Disney, where there's the, you know, like, this is, I mean, and, like, you know, the sequels to, like, say, Lilo and Stitch, which is also a great show. Like one of my favorite Disney films of recent years. I mean, here we are bagging on Disney, but we're watching it. I know not to bother with Lilo and Stitch 2 and 3 because I know that it's just going to be kind of, you know, there's an audience, we're going to crank it out, nobody cares about it, the people who created it are not involved, you know, Chris Sanders, who created, How to Train Your Dragon and Lilo and Stitch, she's not directly involved with any of the subsequent Lilo and Stitch stuff. And it's just like, if it's direct-to-video, that just means that, you know, it's just sort of, you know, copyright servicing, not actually art. Nobody's actually sitting down and making great, great stories. And they're not trying to. Again, I mean, art and commerce, you know, where, like, we have to make money at it or else we can't do it. I think of it as, I make the money so that I can do the art. I don't do the art to make the money. I make the money to do the art. Because otherwise I wouldn't have time. I'd be too busy flipping burgers to have time to, you know, make the art.
Well, let's hope we don't get to that place. Speaking of which, while we're talking about animation stuff like that, you know, when I was reading Princess Saga, I got this kind of feeling that, you know, this could actually be an interesting little cartoon. Or we want to say animated show. You have, according to your profile on Oni Comics' or Oni Press's website, you've got a background in video games and things like that.
Well,
that's
not my field. You know, like cartoons, putting stuff on the screen that moves is not really my field. That all happens in Los Angeles, a long way away, where a lot of meetings take place to discuss, what's the audience for? You know, who is the audience for this book? And, is this a boy's book? Or who's the audience for this cartoon? Sorry. Is this a boy's cartoon or a girl's cartoon? If it's a girl's cartoon, there needs to be more, like, you know, softer stuff, less punching, less fighting, and more talk about makeup and whatnot. And if it's a boy's book, that we don't, you know, we can't make it a boy's book because there's no male characters, and boys don't want to, you know, they don't want to watch shows that are about, all female characters, regardless of the fact that apparently at least 50% of the My Little Pony audience is boys and men. You know, like, they just, that doesn't, that's just an anomaly. That's an anomaly. That's not real. You know, that's just something that happened. It's not something we can predict. It's not part of our chart. You know, that's why I don't want to get involved in it. I'm not interested. Okay. If they make it into a cartoon, I'll check it out and I'll see how it is. I'm not going to be a jerk about it and not watch it. But I'll be like, I'll probably be like, yeah, this was cute. My book was better.
Okay. That makes sense. You know, I hate to say it, but what movie or cartoon or anything is ever better than the original source material? I can't name one.
I'm sure something exists. but there's plenty, the Silence of the Lambs movie is a better movie than the book was a book.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Just to pick one out of a hat. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a fine book, but it was not, you know, it wasn't as deep as the movie Silence of the Lambs. Mm-hmm. Of course, that was all, you know, then they proceeded to make Hannibal and like Red Dragon and all these terrible movies that like didn't come close to like to mm-hmm. living up to the movie Silence of the Lambs and blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
But okay. So there's that. That's one. Mm-hmm. I don't know, but there's not a lot. It's not, mm-hmm. it's not common.
Well, you get a sense as to why Princess Ugg is as good as it is because you understand, you know, what the different mediums and how they work. And, you know, the comics, I think that Princess Ugg is perfectly timed to hit the people right now with a story that we can enjoy that we might not, people might not have picked up, say, 3-4 years ago.
Well, we'll see. So, I mean, I don't know. I mean, we'll see how it does. It seems like it's catching some interest. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping that it's going to blow up. Wouldn't that be mm-hmm. nice after 20-something years in this business to actually mm-hmm. have a project that really takes off? But, you know, I kind of want to, like, be cautiously optimistic.
Of course. Yeah, don't get too up in it, and then if it doesn't quite go as high as you would like to go, then you feel badly about it. But,
yeah.
You know, the good news is that a lot of people, and I've been reading some of the reviews of it online, are saying some good things about it, and I'm one of the people that wants to get the word out about how good it is. So
I really appreciate that.
So it's good to be able to talk with you about this. And, again, it's Princess Ugg. It comes from Oni Press. It's really good. It's something, if you haven't had your diet of and your variety filled and gotten that itch scratched, this is the way to go. Get Princess Ugg. It's a very good story. We're going to see character development, shocking of all things. We're going to see action, adventure, and all kinds of great things in it. So Princess Ugg to me is a book that, especially if you're a female reader and interested in the comics industry, I would say go after this book because it's really something great. But if you're a guy, you still should be reading it anyway.
Sweet. Well, thank you very much.
And that's a wrap for this episode. Be back next week when I'll have a conversation with Gilbert Deltrez, one of the creators of Under the Flesh, a new book that's being funded through Kickstarter. So be sure to be here and learn all about it. But until then, keep reading your comics.